Wieder live von Ihrem Toyota-Partner mit diesem Leasing-Auftakt. Der neue Toyota Yaris-Hybrid. Ab 179 Euro im Monat. Ohne Anzahlung. Seine Sicherheitsassistenten laufen mit. Und ja, ab ins Netz mit voller Konnektivität. Auch am Start die Toyota Team Deutschland Sondermodelle. Ohne Anzahlung geht's in die nächste Runde. Jetzt los sprinten zu Ihrem Toyota-Partner.
Starting Grid. Die Formel-1-Show mit Kevin Scheuren und Sophie Affeld. In Zusammenarbeit mit motorsporttotal.com und formel1.de. Keep racing auf meinsportpodcast.de.
Einen wunderschönen guten Tag und herzlich willkommen zu Starting Grid, dem Formel-1-Podcast auf meinsportpodcast.de. Mein Name ist Kevin Scheuren und ich freue mich heute, eine ganz besondere Ausgabe für euch präsentieren zu dürfen. Unser jährlicher F1-Business-Deep-Dive mit Mark Gallagher, dem ehemaligen Marketing- und Kommunikationsleiter bei Jordan. Der hat jahrelang die Strippen gezogen, wenn es darum ging, Sponsoren zu finden für das Team. Hat dann auch später noch für Jaguar, Red Bull und für Cosworth in der Formel 1 gearbeitet und weiß wie kein Zweiter, was es zu beachten gibt, wenn man Sponsoren an Land ziehen möchte als Formel 1-Team. Und das soll heute auch das große Thema sein. Sponsorings in der Formel 1. Wie wichtig sind Sponsoren noch im Jahr 2024? Welche Art von Sponsoring gibt es? Wie wird eigentlich bezahlt in der Formel 1? Geht es da immer nur um Geld oder auch um Barter-Deals, also um Gegengeschäfte? Und wir blicken auf das Thema TV-Rechte, denn die WWE hat einen sehr interessanten Deal mit Netflix bekannt gegeben. 5 Milliarden Dollar für 10 Jahre WWE, also Wrestling, live bei Netflix ab 2025. International schon mal generell, aber in den USA die Flaggschiff-Show Raw und dann im weiteren Verlauf auch die anderen Shows, die noch dazukommen werden. Das ist ein Mega-Deal im Live-Sportmarkt. Und das könnte ein Beispiel dafür sein, wie die Formel 1 in Zukunft zu sehen sein wird. Also wird die Formel 1 zum Streaming wechseln oder bleibt man den TV-Partnern wie zum Beispiel Sky treu? Ein unglaublich interessantes Gespräch. Das Ganze ist auf Englisch. Ich weiß, dass einige von euch dem Englischen nicht so mächtig sind. Ich hoffe, es ist auszuhalten. Marc spricht herausragend gutes Englisch, das man sehr gut versteht, langsam, sodass man auch vielleicht, wenn man nur so Bruchstücke versteht, das verstehen kann. Ich weiß, dass einige dann das vielleicht sich nicht anhören werden, aber ich wünsche euch einfach sehr viel Spaß dabei. Es ist wirklich eine sehr unterhaltsame, sehr informative Stunde 10, die euch da erwartet und ich hoffe, dass ihr Spaß habt. Ich hatte sehr viel Spaß beim Interview führen und ich hoffe, das kommt für euch auch rüber. Also viel Spaß jetzt mit Mark Gallagher hier bei Starting Grid, dem Formel 1 Podcast auf meinsportpodcast.de. I'm really happy to be joined today by a good friend of the podcast who's doing his yearly F1 Business Deep Dive with me today. I'm really happy to be joined by Mark Gallagher. Hi Mark, how are you?
I'm really good and thanks so much for inviting me back. I didn't realize it was an annual event, but I'm very happy to hear that. And looking forward to talking about the new season and the commercial side of the business.
Yeah, and it's a really interesting, Formula One has become a mainstream phenomenon more than ever before, it seems to me at least, because I mean, we here in Germany, we had it in mainstream when Michael Schumacher was reigning all over F1, then we had Sebastian Vettel, but when you see, and you are now right between coming from Australia, a short layover, going back to America, where Formula One is booming, like I was in Las Vegas, and it was amazing to see how many mainstream fans F1 now has in America.
Yeah, it's crazy. I'm so pleased you had a good time in Vegas, because I had never been to Las Vegas until a year ago, and now I will be. I think this week when I go, it will be the fifth time that I've spent a few days in Vegas. And what it tells you is that here in Europe, particularly, we have no idea how big Formula One has become in the United States. And, you know, when you talk to team principals or drivers or engineers, and they tell you when they turn up in America now, they need security. There are so many people, you know, people are just going crazy for Formula One. It's fantastic. And I can tell you, Kevin, from a business point of view. So my company and the work that I do is working with corporate clients in Formula One and companies which are wanting to learn from Formula One. The interest in the United States is off the scale. And, what I find so interesting now is when I walk on stage at a conference in Las Vegas or Atlanta or Miami or New York, if I ask the audience how many people follow Formula One, you get really surprising reaction. You get a lot of hands go up. But then the other thing I find really interesting is now how many senior executives of companies will come and talk to me and say, so, Mark, you know, like, I'm not really a big fan of Formula One, but all my kids are. Like, all my kid, my daughter is a big Formula One fan. My son is a Formula One. My daughter is 17 years old. She wants to marry Lando Norris, you know? So you, this is the kind of feedback that you're getting. And so it's building a lot of momentum behind the sport. So, yeah, I mean, the job that Liberty and Formula One have done in America is just incredible. And honestly, I don't think three Grand Prix is enough. I think we could easily see four or five races in the United States.
I have prepared a wide array of topics for our talk today. We start with sponsorships, because although F1 teams get a lot of money from Liberty Media for what they achieved over a year, a sponsorship is paramount in F1. Can you tell us a little bit about how paramount sponsorships are for an F1 team in 2024 and going forward?
Yeah. So if you consider that in a very round figure, there is $1 billion of prize money being distributed by Formula One to the 10 teams. And that distribution is based on a fixed amount of money that every team gets. And then there's a sliding scale of payments. And also some teams get kind of special payments. But anyway, that's another story. But the point is that there's $1 billion being divided amongst the 10 teams. And of course, if you are Red Bull or Mercedes or Ferrari, if you're finishing in the top three in the championship, you know, you're almost getting enough money and prize money to cover the budget cap, you know, so you actually, it's not like you need the sponsorship so much if in simple terms. But of course, what the sponsorship does is for a top team, it enables the top team to employ the best drivers, to employ the best engineers, to invest in their factories and their facilities and their technology. So although the budget cap is fixed, there are a lot of areas that you can spend money on. So sponsorship enables you to invest in the business in lots of ways that take you beyond the budget cap and into areas of growth and investment and building your business. And of course, at the other end of the grid, if you are, for example, the Haas Formula One team, if you're getting the 10th slice of prize money and also you have a small amount of sponsorship, it means that you simply can't invest in being competitive. So you can't attract the best of people. I mean, of course, you're employing very good people, but you cannot go out and headhunt a super, super technical director or a top driver or invest money in research and development. So this is where sponsorship becomes important. Sponsorship used to be 80% of the revenue in Formula One for teams. I mean, it used to be really the most important thing. Sponsorship today is, in average terms, less than 50% of the equation. Some teams have told me that 20% of their budget comes from sponsorship. Some teams have told me actually 40% of our budget comes from sponsorship. So it varies from team to team, but it's still a really important factor. And as everyone can see, some teams are very good at getting sponsors. We can talk about them in a moment. And some teams struggle. And it's something that I find really interesting because particularly at the moment, with the growth of Formula One, in my opinion, if you're not attracting sponsors, you're really doing something wrong because the sport has never been a more attractive proposition to sponsors.
You have a lot of experience in that field. I see right behind you the wonderful model of the Jordan. So you've done a lot of work for a team that was really dependent on serious sponsorship money back in the 90s and 2000s. Can you talk us through the process of getting sponsors? Sometimes people ask me, we will talk about the teams that have many sponsors and not so many sponsors, as you said. But how do sponsorship deals come about? How do we have to imagine a team signing a certain sponsor to having a sticker on the car?
Yeah, there are a number of ways that you can secure a sponsor. I'm going to explain probably three main ways that deals happen. So the first way is that the team itself is going out and targeting particular companies, particular industries. So for example, you're saying, okay, let's look at the bank card payments industry. So let's talk to American Express, let's talk to Visa, let's talk to MasterCard. Visa, for example, has just announced a deal with Red Bull. I did a deal with MasterCard. So you know that the card payments industry, the financial services industry, is a sector that you can target. And the reason for that is that these brands, these companies are global. So you're targeting industries which have got global players. So a world championship is very attractive for a large company, because in very simple terms, if you spend 12 million euros on sponsorship as a company like Visa or MasterCard, there are 24 Grand Prix, so actually each market is contributing like $500,000 or something. In simple terms, it's actually quite, I'm not going to say cheap, it's not cheap, but it's inexpensive. It's a very effective way of spending money for global marketing. So you're targeting industries, and at Jordan and at Red Bull, that's exactly how we work. We sat down and we said, okay, we're going to target this industry. We're going to target this company. You're doing research. You're watching what's in the business press, who's doing well, who's doing badly. So you're basically, as an organization, building a sales process to go out, approach organizations that you feel Formula One is a really good fit for, and then you're making your pitch to them. You're building a relationship and so on. So that's the first way of doing it. The second way of doing it is where you use third-party agencies. And there are a lot of sponsorship agencies around the world, sponsorship agencies in Germany, sponsorship agencies here in the UK, every country in the developed commercial market will have a sponsorship agency and sponsorship industry that you can build relationships with. And that's very fertile ground, because if you can imagine one Formula One team trying to approach thousands of companies is difficult. But if one Formula One team then has a network of 50 agencies, and each of those agencies is talking to 20 companies about Formula One, there you have your 1,000 opportunities to secure a deal. And of course, the agencies are hungry, so they want to do a deal. They will charge you a commission, so they will take a percentage. So it might be 10%, it might be 20%, it might be 30%. I've seen all kinds of commissions paid over the years. But the point is that the agency will go out, do the work, build a relationship. And what a lot of agencies do is agencies will build relationships with all the Formula One teams, and the agency will then come to you and say, okay, I have a sponsor and they really want to sponsor your team because they want to sponsor a winning team. So from 2023, that means that there's only two teams that were winning. So it's Ferrari or Red Bull. At Jordan, we secured sponsorship not by promising winning, but by promising that we work really hard with the sponsor every week, every day, 52 weeks of the year, 365 days of the year. And so although we couldn't guarantee winning, we could guarantee that we would work with the sponsor to really maximize the marketing for them. So the agency community comes second. And then the third way is a much, much more kind of intangible way, but it's where you're using all your available channels to network with the business community. So This can involve your public relations and your media work. So you're building a reputation in the media. And of course, if you're building a reputation in the media, then sponsors may contact you. You know, you might literally get the telephone call to say, hello, we like you. We're thinking of sponsoring, you know, we're looking at football, we're looking at tennis, but actually we think Formula One could be a good fit for us. So by using your marketing power as a Formula One team, you're attracting people who want to come and do business with you. And that can also be quite a powerful way of attracting sponsors by using your personal networks. So for example, you're going to events, you're meeting people, you're getting invited to other events. So you end up going to speak at a conference in Milan, and suddenly at that conference you meet an Italian company, and then they start talking to you, and the next thing you discover the chief executive really likes Formula One and they've been thinking about Formula One. And so really those networking opportunities become a very powerful way of building relationships. And sponsorship is fundamentally triggered by building relationships. So it's the team doing it directly, it's an agency doing it, or it's just using the power of the platform of Formula One to attract companies to you.
Are sponsorships in F1 always monetary deals, or are they also like barter deals on any given substance that is useful in context of the sponsor at hand?
Honestly, Kevin, it really depends on the product or services the sponsor has. Barter deals are less interesting because it usually means that the sponsor or the supplier does not have a financial appetite for Formula One, so they just want to give you some product. And that's not really so interesting in a lot of cases. Sometimes it can work very well. For example, a deal which I did at Jordan was with Hewlett-Packard, HP. And it was quite a small deal on paper, and it was a barter. Barter is maybe not the right term, but it was a product deal. So they provided us with about $1.5 million of IT equipment every year. But here's the thing, Kevin. The $1.5 million was not the cost of the equipment, it was the cost of renting the equipment. So actually, although the deal said $1.5 million, it was worth a lot more than that. We were getting $5, $6 million worth of equipment provided to us. And the benefit was that every year they would upgrade it, they would renew it, they would make sure we had the latest laptops and hardware and data storage and software applications, and that was incredible. They did a really good job for us. So they were not paying in cash, they were paying in kind. And of course, as a Formula One team, we need information technology solutions. We needed what they had, so that was a great deal. The smallest deal I ever did in terms of barter, which is quite an amusing one, it was with a very small company in England. And it was owned by a guy called David Laidlaw. And David was just a big Formula One fan. But what his company did was they were a stationery and printing company. So they would make your stationery for you, make your letterheads, your paper, your whatever, brochures. And we did a barter deal. And so every press kit, every fan club membership pack, all our stationery, all our posters, all of our printed material was produced by David's little company at no cost to Jordan. It was a very simple deal, but the quality of stuff that we got from them was fantastic. And David was a really happy guy because he could bring his customers to Formula One races. And his customers were like, you're sponsoring a Formula One team? And he was like, yeah, you know, like everything they're doing, you know, we produce it for them. So that worked really well. Where those deals do not work is when someone comes to you with a product or service that you really don't want. You know, it's not interesting. And I've had a lot of people approach me over the years saying, you know, hey, Mark, my company is making, you know, my company is making plastic cups for drinking, and we will give you 50 million plastic cups for drinking if you put our name on the car. Well, the problem is we don't need 50 million plastic cups, so it's not so interesting. And I mean, that's the kind of thing that happens from time to time. What I would say to you finally is that on the barter deals, more often than not, it's a kind of hybrid deal. So there's some product or service and a lot of financial support, or there's a lot of product and service and some financial support, so that there can be a balance of the two. So there are quite a lot of hybrid deals around. So when you look at Formula One teams that are showing technology sponsors, you usually find that those technology sponsors are providing a combination of technology, products and services, and also some financial support to the team. And the mix of that will be part of the negotiation.
If there is financial support, if there is cash being given to the team, is the money given in one payment and in advance, or are there tranches where the team will get a financial injection, let's call it that way, over the course of the season? How does this work in general, or is there nothing to say in general on that point?
Well, I think there is a point to say in general. So in general, there will be a payment schedule. In general, Formula One teams and the sponsors realize that most of the expenses, most of the spend is before the beginning of the season, designing the car, building the car, developing the car, etc. So it would be not unusual to have a payment schedule which was 40% up front and then three payments of 20%, or 25% up front and maybe, you know, three payments of 20% and then one final payment of 15%. So there's usually it's front loaded to some extent. So that's the general case. I have experienced extremes of literally a sponsor paying 12 monthly payments, like over the year, exactly 12 equal payments, because that's how they wanted to do it. I've also experienced sponsors coming and say, actually, our financial year ends at the end of March, and therefore we would like to pay the whole sponsorship at the start of the season. And, you know, we've also seen that. But those are exceptions. The main approach is, as you said, having a tranche paid periodically through the season.
What has been the biggest deal you signed for a team that you worked for?
Yeah, I mean, I think there have been deals that I got involved with certainly in the Jordan days, with, I didn't get so much involved in the Benson and Hedges deal. Eddie Jordan very much negotiated that deal himself with the help of Ian Phillips, who was head of business affairs. I got quite heavily involved in the Deutsche Post deal, which I actually forget the final total of that, but I think it was like probably 36 to 40 million euros over a period of 3 years. And then there have been some deals that I got involved in and I ran them, you know, like personally. So the MasterCard deal was about $7 million over the time that we worked with them. The Hewlett-Packard deal, as I said, the HP deal ran on and on and on for years. I think, I'm pretty sure it was still going when I left the team. So, you know, we'd been with them probably for 10 years. So if you add up all of that, it was a lot of information technology. So the thing that is interesting is that when you look at a team today, let's take a team like McLaren, which has over 50 commercial partners. There is always a tendency for the, you know, the media and the fans and even the team to focus on the main sponsors. So I remember very well, you know, Eddie Jordan talking to me at a meeting on one occasion, and he said, well, of course, our biggest sponsors are Benson and Hedges and Deutsche Post. And then he said the rest of the sponsors are just like bits and pieces. And so myself and Ian Phillips, we sat down and we wrote on a piece of paper the total value of all the bits and pieces. And it came to 35 million.
Oh, bits and pieces, no?
And I remember we went to see Eddie and we said, so all the bits and pieces are like, it's like a third of our revenue. And that is such an important point about Formula One today in 2024, is that there has been a change in the way that Formula One teams target sponsorship, because the reality is in the post-tobacco era, there has never been an industry that has replaced tobacco in that way. Of course, you still have very large deals happening from time to time. If you think about Petronas, if you think about Oracle, of course, with Red Bull Racing. But actually, the trend has gone away from trying to find one big sponsor that funds the team towards finding a portfolio. And the beautiful thing about a portfolio of sponsorship is that all of those sponsors get the opportunity to activate their sponsorship. All of those sponsors contribute their budget towards you. And the cumulative effect of having 40 or 50 companies each giving you perhaps not a huge budget, but like a moderate budget, is really very significant. And of course, it also reduces the risk for the team, because if one sponsor pulls out, you've still got 49 sponsors left. And again, this is nothing new. I remember Frank Williams and Patrick Head talking to me about this 30 years ago. And I remember them saying, you know, it's really very good when you have a portfolio of sponsors, because you're not lying awake at night praying that your big sponsor doesn't pull out because you had some bad results. So I think the portfolio approach is definitely a good one. And I think it's pretty clear to see which teams have been very successful with that in recent years. So it's, you know, for me, that's a very appropriate way for teams to approach sponsorship today.
We will do a short break right now, and we will continue talking about the portfolio sponsorings that we see in F1, and of course also the sponsor hopping we see in F1, and why is it such a Formula One thing to do. So stay tuned here at Starting Grid, Formula One podcast on meinsportpodcast.de.
Wieder live von Ihrem Toyota-Partner mit diesem Leasing-Auftakt. Der neue Toyota Yaris-Hybrid. Ab 179 Euro im Monat. Ohne Anzahlung. Seine Sicherheitsassistenten laufen mit. Und ja, ab ins Netz mit voller Konnektivität. Auch am Start die Toyota Team Deutschland Sondermodelle. Ohne Anzahlung geht's in die nächste Runde. Jetzt los sprinten zu Ihrem Toyota-Partner.
Von 0 auf 100. Aral feiert 100 Jahre mit über 100.000 Gewinnen. Zum Beispiel ein Jahr frei tanken. Jetzt ein Dankeschön, rubbellos zu jedem Einkauf. Alle Infos auf aral.de. Aral, alles super.
We're back here at Starting Grid. I'm talking to Mark Gallagher today about the sponsoring situation in Formula One. And as Mark referred to earlier, McLaren is having a resurgence over the last few years in sponsorings. They alone have the most commercial partners in F1 today. If you look back a few years ago, must have been like 2014, 2015, the McLaren car was barely naked. There weren't any sponsors on the car, maybe a pity sponsor like the champagne sponsor of F1, Chandon, I think it was. But right now, the McLaren is full of sponsors and interesting sponsors as well. We don't only have like their British American Tobacco, the big sponsor they have with Velo, but they also have OKX, which is a crypto sponsor. Then you have beverages like Coca-Cola and Jack Daniels that yep. were not to be seen on any F1 car over the last decade, maybe, or even ever. So how do you... analyze the resurgence of McLaren, especially in the field of commercial partnerships?
I think it comes down to Zak Brown and the fact that he's a guy who is, he eats, lives and breathes deal making. I remember him calling me a Jordan back in, 30 years ago, when he had been trying to develop a career in racing as a driver, and then he started moving into sponsorship. And I remember him talking to me about an opportunity. And here's an American guy, and this is important because it goes back to the beginning of our conversation. This is an American guy who is commercially astute, highly motivated to make deals, and he is running the McLaren team at the time when Formula One belongs to an American company, Liberty Media. It's listed on the New York Stock Exchange. And when the sport has grown in America. So, I mean, Zak is literally the perfect guy to be doing what he's done. Now, he has a great team of people working for him at McLaren. He has a great agency network. And of course, he actually built an agency. So he worked for and then built agencies. Then he built his own company, sold that company, CSM. And of course, he then was invited to join McLaren and effectively has taken over from Ron Dennis as the main guy running that team, albeit he doesn't own the team. The team belongs to the Bahrainis. But Zak is, he is the man of the moment for the commercial industry that Formula One really is, and the proof is in that lineup of sponsorships. And as you said, Kevin, you know, you look at OKX, you look at cryptocurrencies, you look at the fact he's got Google Chrome, you look at British American Tobacco, DP World, Cisco, those are just like five of the companies that they've got. The thing that really blows me away, the thing that must put such a smile on Zak's face every day, is the fact that when you look at the so-called small sponsors at McLaren, when you look at the brands which don't have a huge amount of real estate on the car or the driver's overalls, these are, you know, apparently quite small deals. They're not small deals and they're not small companies. I mean, you're talking about companies like Deloitte or Goldman Sachs or Unilever, or as you mentioned, Coca-Cola, or, you know, Tumi, the luggage company, Tumi. I mean, any of us who walked, when you visit an airport, if you go past a Tumi shop, you see now beautiful photographs of Lando Norris promoting Tumi luggage and all of that. So literally the quality of McLaren's partnerships is so impressive. So from top to bottom, from end to end, all of those deals that they have are with really impressive businesses. And it's a complete 180 degrees from where they were 10 years ago. And it is a very interesting thing to study, because essentially you can see that as McLaren became less successful, as McLaren began to struggle with its leadership, its structure, its succession planning, you know, it was reaching the end of one chapter. As it reached the end of that chapter, it lost a lot of really significant sponsors who had been with them for a long time. Companies like SAP, ExxonMobil, Hugo Boss, you know, it was incredible to see some of these 30-year sponsorships come to an end. And it has taken Zak to rebuild the team and its profile and its commercial proposition. And honestly, if you are on the management board of teams like Williams, teams like Haas, teams like AlphaTauri, teams like Alpine, you know, the easiest thing to do is to look at what McLaren have achieved and say, how could we mirror that? How could we achieve that kind of commercial success? But ultimately, it comes down to having a commercial leader like Zach, who just lives for the deal and networks like crazy.
Let's stay with McLaren right now, because I wanted to talk about the sponsor hopping we see in F1. So McLaren is a very prominent example this year, because they got Monster Energy from Mercedes, and they got Estrella Galicia 0.0 from Ferrari, the alcohol-free beer from Spain. So is this, is there also a little bit of competition to get sponsors like this on your car? Or is it just a thing of the sponsors don't see any more potential in the team they are with? Like, for say, I don't know, there is potential in Mercedes, of course, but they stay with Lewis Hamilton. His exclusive deal with Monster Energy stays intact. And of course, I think Carlos Sainz, I don't know if Carlos Sainz will still be sponsored or in any way supported by Estrella, but they all go to McLaren. But we see those things happening in F1 very often, that one sponsor goes from this team to this team to this team. How and why is this? And is there a certain competition between the teams to get a sponsor of a team to say, okay, I want to go to you?
Well, sometimes sponsors change teams because there is a relationship breakdown for some reason. Could be on a business level, or it could be on a personal level. So you have senior executives who just don't see eye to eye with the team for whatever reason, you know, whatever it could be. And of course, if you are a sponsor of an existing team, you're going to all the races, you're meeting all the other teams in the airport and in the hotels and in the bars and at restaurants. And sometimes a sponsor will then start to question the original decision. So they'll say, okay, so I'm sponsoring this team, but now that I've met this other team, I can see this other team represents a better opportunity. And then, of course, because it is a competitive environment, if another team gets the opportunity to pitch for your sponsorship, of course, one of the easy things to do is to offer you more. So if a sponsor of Mercedes starts talking to a team like McLaren or Red Bull and says to them, okay, so Mercedes give us, you know, in return for the sponsorship, we get this number of passes or tickets, or we get this much branding, or we get a certain number of driver appearances, or we get a certain type of licensing deal. You can then start to try and beat that. You know, how can you improve? Instead of giving you 100 passes a year, we'll give you 150 passes a year. Or instead of giving you 4 driver appearances over the year, we're going to give you 14 driver appearances over the year. And it can be as simple as that. So it's a very dynamic environment. It is very much about people. It's about their feeling. It's about the benefits that their business is accruing from the team that they're sponsoring. And if I can just finish this and say that, for example, at Jordan and then again at Red Bull when I was there, one of the things that I did every year was to make a list of all the sponsors of all the other teams, and I would regard those sponsors as potential targets, because if I can see someone sponsoring a team and I can see that that sponsor is not being treated very well, if I can see that there's an opportunity for us to offer something better, then that becomes a very interesting conversation to have. And it is a competitive landscape. So you're going to get that movement, you are going to get that movement over time. And this is why a successful Formula One team, like any successful business, will put a lot of effort into building long-term customer relationships, because the better the quality of your relationship with your sponsors, the less likely it is that the sponsor is going to leave you and go to another team. Can I just finish by telling you one of my favorite stories?
Absolutely. Please go ahead.
When Flavio Briatore was running the Benetton team, He offered Eddie Jordan the opportunity to go on vacation to Flavia. It was very nice. He had a beautiful holiday home in Africa, and he used to go there with, you know, his supermodel girlfriends and whatever. So he invited, he said to Eddie, look, I'd like to give you my villa for 2 weeks. So Eddie went away on a like 2 week vacation to Africa and had a great time. And what he didn't realize was that while he was on vacation in Flavio's villa, Flavio was busy approaching Benson and Hedges to try and get them to leave Jordan and go to Benetton. So when Eddie came back from holiday, you know, he had like a meeting with Benson and Hedges, and they said, well, Eddie, you know, we've had a really good offer from Flavio. You know, he came to see us last week and we had a very nice lunch, and, you know, he's really, and it's so amusing, but actually that's the nature of the Formula One business. You know, we are, you know, it's a cutthroat industry. And you can imagine Flavio thinking, how can I get rid of Eddie for 2 weeks so that, you know, I can approach his sponsor? So the easiest thing is to, I'll give him my villa and tell him to go and have a great time. So it's kind of indicative of just the competitive nature in Formula One, whether it's on the racetrack or whether it's in the boardroom, we're all trying to beat the opposition.
What was it with Eddie and Flavio over stuff like Michael Schumacher back in the day when Flavio took the carpet under Eddie's hopes that he has the future world champion in his team, get him to Benetton, yeah. And then Benson and Hedges as well. Easy target for him.
I mean, the thing is that, you know, going back to those days, and I think it's changed a little bit now, but going back to those days, you had team principals who, in many cases, owned the team. So you had Ron Dennis, you had Frank Williams, you had Tom Walkinshaw, you had Eddie Jordan, you had, you know, Flavio Briatore didn't own the team, but he had complete control over it. And how I would describe it is that they kind of loved each other and they hated each other. So they were kind of like in love with the passion of doing Formula One, and they really respected each other. But on the other side, they really wanted to like kill each other. I mean, kill each other in the nicest way possible. They wanted to destroy the competition, you know. So it, and I think today, obviously, the sport is, in my opinion, much more professional. The way things are done is today quite different from how it was in the past. But the same thing is still there in terms of, if you talk to Christian Horner or you talk to Toto Wolff or you talk to Frédéric Vasseur, you know, they still want to be the best at what they do. And that includes not only winning the races, but winning the deals, getting the sponsorships in. And they will fight hard, you know, to get those deals. And they will do whatever they need to do to make it happen. You know?
What do you think is more attractive for a potential sponsor? To be one of the smaller fishes, quote unquote, in a big pond, or having a team where you are more prominent, which is basically not going to be as successful, but you will get, if it's a midfield team, let's say, you will get enough TV time, you will get enough attention to have your name at least out in the public as much as possible, but you are not one of those little stickers on the Red Bull or the McLaren or the Mercedes.
Yeah. I mean, so one of my proudest moments at Jordan was in 1999 and 2000, we had the most incredible portfolio of sponsors. And I remember Ron Dennis giving an interview, and he said, I really don't understand why Jordan have so many sponsors, because they have achieved nothing. You know, like, they're compared to McLaren, Jordan is nothing. And it made me laugh, because the way that we sold sponsorship was to say to companies, look, if you want to do Formula One on a cost-efficient basis and you want to have a program that means that Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, we are working with you to make your sponsorship successful. That that is what we can offer you. We can offer you a 365-day-a-year, 52-week business relationship. And it means that if you're having a conference in Frankfurt or an exhibition in Hamburg and you need Hans Harald Frentzen to come there and meet your customers, or you need Eddie Jordan to come and speak at a dinner, we can make all of that happen. Whereas if you sponsor McLaren or Ferrari, you will first of all have to write a very big check. Secondly, you will find that when you ask, is it possible to have an appearance from Mika Häkkinen, they will tell you, actually, he's not available. You can't have him. You know, he's too busy. It's not in Mika's contract to do this. So we used to work very hard to sell something other than winning. And so in answer to your question, if a sponsor comes to me and says, I don't know if I should sponsor Red Bull or I don't know if I should sponsor Haas, I would say to them, well, what's going to make your business happy? So what makes you happy? What's the thing that will make you satisfied? If you will only be satisfied by your team winning every race so that you can tell your customers and tell your employees, hey, we're winning every race, then you're going to need to do a small team, small deal with Red Bull, and you're a happy person. If, however, your objective is that you really want to have a Formula One driver come to your annual conference, your product launch, your exhibition, meet your staff, meet your customers, you want to have the Formula One car come to do a demonstration in your home city, la 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 la, it's probably better you do a deal with a team like Haas, because they have the bandwidth to do that and they have the motivation. So the smaller teams can offer different things from the larger teams. That's certainly my experience of it. And there's, as you go from one end of the grid to the other, there's a balance, you know, to be achieved in terms of the creativity of a deal and what you get out of it. But ultimately, the important thing is to ask the sponsor, what will make you happy? What's the value in this for you? What's the thing that will make you excited about working with us? If it's winning Formula One races, you need to go and talk to the top two teams. If it's all the other stuff, we can have a conversation now. And that becomes the most important thing, understanding what it is the customer wants and then building a deal for them.
Let's, as a final topic for the sponsorship subject we have today, talk about title sponsoring. When I look at the entry list, we see Oracle at Red Bull, Petronas at Mercedes. We see Aramco with Aston Martin, BWT with Alpine, Visa and Cash App with formerly AlphaTauri, now with RB. I have no idea. We will have a hard time talking about this team, because we basically have to talk about sponsors. Stake F1 team with the kick when they they're not allowed to do crypto stuff and casino stuff in different countries, and MoneyGram with Haas. But there are still teams without title sponsors, like Ferrari, like McLaren, like Williams. So what is the financial threshold to be a title sponsor in Formula One? And how attractive is it to be a title sponsor? And what does it mean if a credit card company like Visa now decides to do a title sponsoring in Formula One with formerly AlphaTauri?
Yeah. The threshold question is a hard one to answer, because in simple terms, the easiest way to do a big deal is come in with 60, 75 million euros, own the name of the team, own the branding of the team, do a five-year deal. So it's 5x60 or 5x75. So you could be a 300 million euro deal over 5 years. And you can just own the thing. You can own the name. You can own the branding. You can have the drivers with your name across their overalls, etc. There are not many of those deals around in Formula One. We mentioned Oracle. We mentioned Petronas. I then think if you look at a team like Ferrari, the reality is that Ferrari doesn't have a title sponsor because Ferrari has got so many large secondary, I'm calling them secondary only because they're not titled, but they've got so many large deals supporting them. And so again, Ferrari have gone for the portfolio approach. And I think as many of the listeners will know, Ferrari's major partner for a very, very, very long time has been Philip Morris and Marlboro, and Philip Morris continue to have a significant involvement. So there is a the threshold question is easily answered by come in with a lot of money and anything is possible. But then the what has become quite an interesting pitch is where you come in with a more modest amount of money. So it could be like 20 million, 30 million euros, and you get the name, but you don't get the color of the team, huge amounts of branding. So you become with a more modest kind of package. So a good case study on that was some of the listeners will remember when Williams were sponsored by AT&T. So there was the AT&T Williams deal. That AT&T deal was quite a small deal financially, but what they were paying for was the name. So they got the name, the branding was quite small. And so again, you're talking about a kind of hybrid deals where you're trying to match the money to what it is the sponsor wants. If they want the name of the team, you can sell that to them without selling all of the branding. And then, of course, you come to the really interesting topic, which is, you know, the title sponsor, and they get the name of the team, but do they really get the name of the team with the fans? Do they really get the name of the team with the media? So, you know, there was a very funny I think it was a tweet from a friend of mine, Andrew Benson, who covers Formula One for the BBC in the UK, and he said that after the stake deal was announced, you know, to take over from Alfa Romeo, he said, we had a conversation in the BBC office about what do we call the team. And he said, after 5 minutes, we decided we'll still call them Sauber, you know, because essentially that's what it is. And I think this is, you know, this is the challenge for title sponsors. You get a lot of visibility. You get the logo, you get the team name, you get on all the assets, you get lots of press coverage from the way Formula One now is generating coverage across lots of different channels. But fundamentally, you're not going to find television commentators or fans saying, oh, here comes the Aramco Aston Martin, followed by the Stake F1, followed by the MoneyGram Haas. I mean, that doesn't happen and it's not going to happen. But owning the naming rights definitely gives you a lot of prestige, and it does give you a lot of opportunity to communicate your brand in ways that secondary sponsors don't enjoy.
Yeah, I think the Visa thing will be tricky because you cannot say RB, because it's difficult to not say like Red Bull to it, although it's Racing Bulls or I don't know. Then you don't want to say Visa Cash App RB all the time, or VCA RB or whatever. So this is a tricky one for us this year, I think. But it's also, I think it's a good sign that there are still companies that are willing to pay a lot of money, or not as much money as they would pay for other sponsors. But just one last thing. When you see the Cash App thing, Cash App has been a sponsor with Red Bull. Now, Red Bull is giving a sponsor their sister car. This is interesting when you see like Ferrari and Haas, when you have more teams working together closely, not as close as Red Bull and Toro Rosso would do. But is that something that can be? Because we always speculate, how many satellite teams will there be in F1 for the big teams? Like Mercedes has Williams in a way, that sponsors that are not the biggest part of the main team can become a bigger part of the secondary team.
Yeah, it's relatively rare that that is going to happen. The Red Bull RB relationship is, of course, quite different because they're literally sister companies through the Red Bull ownership. And actually, going back to what we were talking earlier on, it's very easy to imagine a scenario where the Visa Cash App people are talking to Red Bull Racing and saying, oh gosh, we would love to be the main sponsor of your team, but of course you've got Oracle. And then Red Bull go, ah, but we have an idea for you. You could go to our sister team, you could go to AlphaTauri, and you can get those benefits. And by the way, you can get those benefits probably for quite a lot less money than it would cost you at Red Bull Racing. So again, it's about relationships. It's about what do you want to get out of it. And the great thing for Visa is it doesn't really matter that the RB team, formerly AlphaTauri, formerly Toro Rosso, formerly Minardi, formerly, it doesn't really matter that they're not a competitive team at the present time, because Visa, as a global brand, they will just market the heck out of the fact that they have the name of a Formula One team. So for them, it's all about participating in this huge global sport of Formula One. And if they get any good results, if somehow they got on the podium, or somehow it was, raining in Spa and suddenly they got pole position or something, I mean, that's going to be like a very extra special day. But that's not the reason why they're sponsoring that team. They're sponsoring that team to leverage the brand through Formula One to the global audience.
Such a fascinating topic. We will do another short break now and then do a break in topics, because we'll talk about TV rights and is Formula One bound for streaming. Stay tuned here with Starting Grid.
Wieder live von Ihrem Toyota-Partner mit diesem Leasing-Auftakt. Der neue Toyota Jahreshybrid. Ab 179 Euro im Monat. Ohne Anzahlung. Seine Sicherheitsassistenten laufen mit. Und ja, ab ins Netz mit voller Konnektivität. Auch am Start die Toyota Team Deutschland Sondermodelle. Ohne Anzahlung geht's in die nächste Runde. Jetzt los sprinten zu Ihrem Toyota-Partner.
One last time, I welcome you back here to Starting Grid, the Formula One podcast on meinsportpodcast.de. My name is Kevin Scheuren. Mark Gallagher is my guest today. We talked a lot about sponsoring, but there is something that is taking a lot of interest for me right now, and is TV rights. Let's talk about TV rights, because I don't know if you know, but I'm a huge wrestling fan. So WWE scored a big deal, talk about deals, with Netflix starting in 2025. The flagship show Raw will air in the US on Netflix, and internationally every show they produce will be airing on Netflix. And it is to be for certain that the WWE network, like the archive you have, will also be transferred to Netflix in a way over the next few years. It's a 10-year deal with a value of $5 billion, which is quite amazing. And I have a lot of discussions with my colleague Sasha about the projection of Formula One in TV and television, or is Formula One bound for streaming only? Just before we go on and talk about the lengths of the deals that Formula One has with certain TV partners, when you see something like that, like the WWE deal they do with Netflix, how do you react just personally on that front?
Well, I react personally because of, in a way that reflects my background, really. Because when I heard about the WWE deal, my first reaction was, why have these deals not happened sooner? Because for me, it has been so obvious for a long time that there is a huge opportunity for sports, globally recognized sports, to offer themselves to the streaming giants. And the streaming giants need to develop a strategy that sucks in subscribers and viewers and eyeballs. And of course, you have Disney Plus, you have Apple TV, you have Amazon Prime, you have Netflix, you have all these different platforms all investing billions and billions and billions of dollars on TV series, on movies, on documentaries, on you know, they're looking for content. But actually, the easiest content to get hold of is a sport that happens every year around the world, because you literally don't have to do it. I mean, you literally can just buy that, and then the sport generates your content for you every week, every fortnight, and you've got an audience. And if the audience knows that they have to go to Netflix to watch WWE, then that's where they're going to go. And by the way, what Netflix has already proven with something like Drive to Survive is you don't even have to show the racing to build an audience for Formula One. I mean, literally, the Netflix Drive to Survive story shows that if you put enough creativity into the storytelling around a global sport like Formula One, you don't even have to show the racing because there is so much else to talk about. And I remember back in, oh my goodness, it must be like 2015 or 2016, I was invited to join a panel at a conference in Dubai, and they said to me, you know, where do you think Formula One will go after Bernie Ecclestone? And I said, well, one of the things that they could do is they could just sell Formula One to a media company like Amazon or, you know, one of the big players, because at that time I pointed out Formula One was generating $1 billion a year in television revenue, okay, $1 billion. This sounds like a lot of money. Unfortunately, $1 billion today is not that much. And what the WWE deal shows is if you've done a 10-year deal and you've been prepared to pay $5 billion for that for 10 years for WWE, then what could Formula One potentially be worth? And the answer is many times that. And I think what Formula One have done under Liberty has been incredibly clever, because we have moved from a business model where you sold television rights to one broadcaster in each country around the world. You know, in the old days in Europe, it was RTL in Germany. You know, it was BBC in the UK. It was Rai in Italy. Of course, now you have the opportunity, like Formula One has done, they sell the rights to, first of all, a cable or satellite broadcast channel, probably on a pay-per-view basis. Then they sell a highlights package to terrestrial television like they do here in the UK. Then on top of that, in a number of countries around the world, you have your Formula One TV subscription package, so you have your F1 TV offering. And what Liberty and Formula One have done is they have grown the cake. You know, they've made the cake even bigger, and they're slicing it in lots of different ways according to what type of media you are: streaming, terrestrial television, you know, packaging it in lots of different ways. And so this has grown the sport exponentially. Where do we go next? I still think what I said back in 2015, 2016, if you were a Jeff Bezos at Amazon, if you were an Apple, you would have to look at Formula One at some point and say, I wonder what Liberty's appetite would be for us to buy the whole thing. We literally, now that doesn't mean that it's only available on Apple TV or it's only available on Amazon. But what it means is that you can control it. Because if you buy it, you can then package it and you can perhaps sub-license it on a national basis in key markets as well. And there's, again, a very rich way to do that. So WWE deal for me is a really important deal, and it shows the potential of what is out there for other sports. And as the war between the big streaming companies grows, and that war is only going to, you know, it's only going to get tougher, I think they become very attractive to place bids for big, globally recognizable sports like Formula One. So I'll be interested to have a look at what the share price of Formula One does off the back of the WWE deal.
If we look at current deals F1 has in certain markets, we have Sky UK until 2029. We have Channel 4, as you said, one of the highlights packages, but of course also the British Grand Prix and the season finale also is broadcasted there until 2026. We have ESPN Disney until 2025 in the US. We have in Austria Service TV and ORF until 2026, and Sky Germany has it until 2027, with RTL having a sub license for 7 races now until 2025. So is it to the detriment of F1 right now, as it is obvious that Netflix is trying to have more live sports on their network? Of course, also Amazon Prime is really taking the cake, is taking part of the cake, the sports market cake, that the deals are running as long as they do right now. Because when you look, just you need to look like 5-6 years in front now to have a grasp of how much you can ask for your TV rights deals. Or would you say, it was interesting that you said that earlier, that it will not only be about TV rights, but about ownership of F1 when we get into 2029, 2030.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to hear your summary of those deals, because with the exception of the Sky deal going on to 2029, you know, when you talk to me about deals that are finishing in 2025, 2026, even 2027, you know, at the end of the day, Kevin, that's only 2-3 years away. I mean, it's actually quite short term. It's actually not that difficult to see Formula One / Liberty putting together really big long-term deals that will start in the next 2 or 3 years and will take over into the future. The relationship with Sky is incredible and is intense. But my own view is that Formula One as a product is now much more powerful than it was 5 years ago. And I think Sky will have to work hard to keep that special relationship. They're going to have to continue pumping in a great deal of money. And I think a deal like the WWE deal with Netflix probably illustrates that no matter what Sky are paying, it's actually less than they really ought to pay for the kind of exclusivity that they have and that they want into the future. So it's an incredibly competitive marketplace. Now that we're into 2024 and we're looking potentially 5 years ahead to the end of the decade, the next 5 years are going to be a really interesting time, because in the next 5 years, a number of things will happen. First of all, Liberty will see the new Formula One formula in 2026, the new regulations come in. Second thing is Liberty will then have owned Formula One for 10 years. So they bought Formula One at the end of 2016. You know, so 2027, they'll have owned it 10 years. What do Liberty do next? You know, do they continue to grow it, or do they have a day where they cash in and they sell the business? I mean, Formula One is now heading, you know, it's now a $30 billion business in terms of its value. And you have Greg Maffei, the chairman, openly admitting that he believes Formula One is worth a lot more than that. And I think he's right. I think Formula One might be a $30 billion business today, but I think Liberty could grow it to $40, $50 billion. And that's the point at which it will be so attractive for them to sell it. And who they sell it to will be the next chapter in Formula One's evolution. And I would not put it beyond the possibility of one of the streaming giants being the company that decides to take Formula One from Liberty.
Let's draw another comparison to WWE. It's interesting because the comparisons are are really, really good to make. WWE was sold to, or they merged with UFC under the Endeavor banner. Like Endeavor is also a big media conglomerate in the States. But also Saudi Arabia made a bid. They even made the cash bid. That was interesting because WWE did not take the most cash because Saudi Arabia would have given the most cash. When you see on perspective with Formula One, when we had this rumor last year that Apple wants to have worldwide exclusivity for F1 media rights from 2029 onwards. It's interesting that this all comes together right now, also for our chat here. Would it be better if Liberty Media would sell F1 or would sell the rights or would sell the license to F1 to a media conglomerate in the States rather than having it sold to Saudi Arabia, maybe, even if Saudi Arabia would pay the most money to own it, because you will have this network and you will have this strength you've built up over 10 years, over 12 years then, that you can give to a new partner who is doing it in the interest of what you build up with the strong foundation it will have by then.
Yeah. I mean, it's a really fascinating question. Listeners who follow some of the deals that happen in sport will know that the Saudis decided to invest a lot in football. They decided to invest a lot in golf. They created the LIV Golf Championship. At the beginning, there was a lot of resistance, but they threw enough money on the table to make the resistance disappear. So a lot of people were happy to take the money. And I think, you know, we have to be realistic. There are a lot of people out there for whom the number is the only thing that matters. How big a number can I get? How much money can I make out of it? And therefore, the buying power of the Saudis, or indeed other governments in the Gulf region, it's very attractive. You know, they have very good buying power. However, the one thing that they may have buying power, but that does not mean that they have the expertise to run the business and grow the business. And that's where a media company will have more potential. So if you look at the deal that happened in 2016, I was so happy that CVC Capital sold Formula One to Liberty Media. Why? Because under CVC Capital, as a private equity deal, they weren't investing in the sport. They weren't growing the sport in the way it needed to. And under Liberty, they have grown it because they're a media company. They're an entertainment company. They know how to make a product attractive to audiences. They have grown the sport on social media. They have grown the sport with new audiences, younger audiences, diverse audiences, more women, more girls than ever following Formula One. Liberty have done a fantastic job. For me, the next step is that if Liberty decided to sell it, would be to sell it to a large media entity like one of the streaming giants, because the streaming giants will recognize the value, so they will pay the money. And secondly, they will have the competence and the capability to grow it. So, you know, no disrespect meant to the Saudis or any other sovereign funds, but a sovereign wealth fund buying a sport of Formula One is going to struggle to have the capability to grow it into the future in the same way that a media company would. So my own view on it is that this is an entertainment sport, and it should be owned by people who understand entertainment, who understand audiences, who understand to take this great sport of Formula One and make it even more attractive to all the fans around the world.
Will be fascinating to observe the bidding war we will have between Apple, Netflix, and Amazon Prime to own Formula One TV rights or even more in the future. Mark, it was a pleasure to talk to you today. I'm so thankful that you made the time between all your travels to talk to me, to talk to our listeners. And I think we should not wait until next year to do this again. There are so many subjects that we didn't even scratch the surface. So maybe we can do it another time this year. Mark, thank you very much.
That's great. Have a great season.
You can follow Mark on Instagram and on the X _ Mark Gallagher if you like. Please do so. And it was a pleasure to have Mark on today. And now I switch to German. Danke euch fürs Zuhören. Es war mir eine Freude, heute mit Mark Gallagher über viele Themen sprechen zu können. Und wie gesagt, ich versuche das dieses Jahr nochmal mit ihm zu machen, um einfach noch ein paar weitere Themen hier in Starting Grid für euch zum Thema F1 Business
rüber zu bekommen. Wenn ihr also Kommentare habt, wenn ihr Fragen habt, wenn ihr, ja, wenn ihr was loswerden wollt zu dem, was wir besprochen haben, dann schreibt es gerne in die Kommentare unter das YouTube-Video auf dem YouTube-Kanal von Formel1.de oder eben auch auf unseren sozialen Netzwerken. Das war Starting Grid für diese Woche. Nächste Woche gibt es eine neue Ausgabe, da freue ich mich jetzt schon drauf. Bleibt uns also gewogen, bleibt gesund, passt aufeinander auf und keep racing.
Starting Grid, die Formel-1-Show mit Kevin Scheuren und Sophie Affeld. In Zusammenarbeit mit motorsporttotal.com und Formel1.de. Keep racing auf meinsportpodcast.de.
Wieder live von Ihrem Toyota-Partner mit diesem Leasing-Auftakt. Der neue Toyota Yaris-Hybrid. Ab 179 Euro im Monat, ohne Anzahlung. Seine Sicherheitsassistenten laufen mit und ja, ab ins Netz mit voller Konnektivität. Auch am Start die Toyota Team Deutschland Sondermodelle. Ohne Anzahlung geht's in die nächste Runde. Jetzt los sprinten zu Ihrem Toyota-Partner.
Von 0 auf 100. Aral feiert 100 Jahre mit über 100.000 Gewinnen. Zum Beispiel ein Jahr frei tanken. Jetzt ein Dankeschön, rubbellos zu jedem Einkauf. Alle Infos auf aral.de. Aral, alles super.